What's up? Welcome to NExpress, the Nintendo show of GoombaStomp.com. My name is Tim Mason. I will be your captain today alongside Patrick Murphy.
What's up, Tim Mason? What's up, Nintendo Country?
Oh, hey, look at that. Nintendo Country, not Nation this time.
Ah, I knew I screwed that up. Again.
our other co-pilot, Ricky D, is not here today. He is in the middle of a ginormous family conflict involving cats and dogs, quite literally, which is very funny. But all the best, Rick. I hope you get that resolved, and I hope it all ends up nice and smooth and no fur shed. See what I did there?
Mass hysteria, Tim, is what they call that. Cats yeah. and dogs living together.
Just pandemonium. Isaac Burnett's here again. Hey, Isaac, how's it going?
Going good. I'm glad to be here again.
And we're excited to have you. You've been doing a segment for us all about the tech behind all of these consoles that we love and cherish. And you're all the way to the 64 now.
Yep. Keep on working on those and just getting them out as I can. But yeah, working on the... You know, we talked about the NES and Super Nintendo last time, so I can't wait to get into it this time.
So, I mean, it's really all about the N64, so that's what matters. Pretty excited about that. We also are talking about Super Mario Maker 2, which came out. And don't share any opinions just yet, you guys. I'm really excited about this, though. So that'll be our main segment. And joining us for that, because he covered it for the site, is Ty Davidson. How's it going, Ty?
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, of course. It's always nice to have a fellow fan on the site. And you guys, it's a pretty cool day for all Nintendo fans, I feel like, because our first segment is going to be all about the Switch Lite that just got announced today. That just happened out of the blue. And we have a lot to look forward to with this as more people can hop on the Switch bandwagon, and I've just got to say, this thing is pretty sleek. I'm really liking the look of it, and the price point, I don't know if you can beat that at all. $200. Knocked off a full $150, if I'm remembering right.
No, just $100.
Oh, just $100? Yeah, just $100.
That's where I would dispute with you, that I feel like the price point is, for what you're getting, the regular Switch is a way, way better deal.
Yeah.
Because if you consider the dock, you're missing the dock, which retails for $90. You're missing the Joy-Cons, which retail for $80. And you're missing an HDMI cable, which retails for like $10 to $15. I mean, you're basically losing out on $120, $130. Or no, even more than that. What am I talking about? It's like $180 worth of stuff. But they're only knocking $100 off the retail price.
Yeah, that's one thing I thought. I thought this launches at $150, it would sell amazingly. Yeah. So it might sell good at $200, but $150 would have been a better price point. But at that point, they'd probably be losing money on it. So
I think it'll sell. I just don't think it's as good of a deal as it looks. I think the regular Switch is a far superior deal.
Well, I think any day of the week, you should still pick up the standard edition Switch. Honestly, like I completely understand that, but I do think that there is a customer out there for this product. I think that this has a place in the family lineup, and maybe it's for that more casual player who really just wants to pick it up this year for Pokemon and Animal Crossing. Maybe those are your two games. And I think that rather than spend the $300, maybe you just want to play the thing on the go. Maybe you just want to pick up a Pokemon edition Switch and play Pokemon, you know? I think that there is a cool market for this product, and if that's your jam, then go for it. I think it's similar to the 2DS. Like, yeah, I personally would never, ever touch that thing. I'm like, this is wacky looking. What's up with the two screens? I don't like this. It looks like a doorstop. I would rather buy just a 3DS, but that's me. But there are people out there that have 2DSs, that it was the right price point. So I think... Getting a new console that came out in 2017 down to $200 already, I think that's a good price point. I know it's not the better value, but it's still good.
Well, let me explain why. I have a lot of problems with this, and I know there are a lot of people excited. And if you're excited and this is what you, the route you want to go because you only care about handheld, then fine. But I think there are a lot of problems with this. And I explained this before when my concern about having a Switch like this is, first of all, why is it called the Switch? You're losing. I don't think this is like the 2DS because the 2DS is actually named appropriately. It's a dual screen still, and it just happens to be 2D instead of 3D. It doesn't provide a 3D effect. This, however, is not a Switch. There's nothing Switch about this. It doesn't switch from your television. You're losing the main selling point of the Switch was this convenience of being able to go from TV to handheld, TV to handheld, and do it seamlessly. Well, that's no longer the case. It's just a glorified Vita in many ways. It just plays Nintendo games. That's all. It's Nintendo's next handheld. It doesn't do anything special. And there are a couple other problems that I have. So obviously, you know, there's no Joy-Cons with this, right? Well, Joy-Con controller analog stick drift has been a huge problem, and I've been affected by it, and there are ways to clean it and everything like that, but you got to be a little delicate with it, and I don't think kids are going to necessarily know how to do this. Well, it's a lot easier to replace a Joy-Con if it goes bad than it is to send in your entire Switch and have that fixed if these sticks go bad, and I'd be concerned about, like, buying this thing, and 6 months later, the analog stick is drifting. And then I have to send in my entire Switch as opposed to just, like, picking up an extra set of Joy-Cons. And then in the meantime, I can still play my Switch and then sending a Joy-Con in to get repaired or something. I don't know, man. I don't like this thing at all. I think the branding is going to confuse people at the stores. I think when their kids want a Switch and they go in and they see the Switch Lite, and they're like, oh, that's cheaper. They might think they're getting a real Switch, but they're not. And it can never be converted, as far as I can tell, to a real Switch. So you're losing out on a big selling point, and I'm not sure that you've differentiated the two well enough. The 2DS and 3DS thing, that was a minor change. The 3D was a gimmick that was never really like a big selling point, a big draw for the 3DS. The dual screens were more the big draw, and the 2DS doesn't lose that. I don't know. I feel like the ability to switch between TV and handheld is a big draw for the Switch. That I think that's a huge reason as to why it's successful and why people are interested in it. Like, over 4th of July, I was visiting, you know, a friend of mine and his family, his brother and his wife and kids were at this cabin, and they found out that I wrote about video games, blah, blah. Do you have a Nintendo Switch? What do you think of the Nintendo Switch? And they love the idea of being able to switch back and forth. They don't know anything about video games. But they could easily confuse this at the store for just being the same Switch. I don't know. Maybe you guys can tell me I'm wrong. But I just feel like there are problems with this thing. And I know a lot of people like it. I've seen it on the message boards. There are a lot of people who are in favor of this. And I'm sure a lot of people just want a game handheld, and that's fine. But man, it just does not seem like a good deal to me.
I think for me, I was watching the commercial, and I was like, huh. This is interesting. It's an interesting idea. It's kind of like, I mean, everybody saw it coming, the Switch yeah. Lite, Switch on the go. But I was like watching the video and I'm like, this is awesome, but not awesome for me. Like, I'm not the target audience for this product ultimately. Like, I was watching the ad and, you know, it's like got all these kids on skateboards meeting out at the skate park and playing. And then like they're in bed after doing their homework for the night and they're playing in bed and stuff like that. And I was like, this is great, but just not for me. I think
but you can do it with a regular Switch. All
sure.
Stuff you can
but hear me out. Hear me Switch. Out. Hear me out. I think that ultimately what they're going for is they're going for that target market of like 10 to like 16-year-old kids who are like, mom, I want a Switch. But mom's like, oh, you're going to break it. You're going to lose all the little pieces. All the little Joy-Cons are going to come off and you're going to lose them and your friends are going to take them and all this stuff or whatever. So I'll buy you the cheaper version. And then if you drop it at the skate park or whatever, it's not a big deal. Keep in mind, these are people, this is like a demographic that doesn't own a TV. Like, they don't have a TV. I mean, ideally, I mean, Nintendo's eyes, maybe they don't own a TV and have it in their bedroom or whatever. So their parents don't want them competing for the living room space when they're trying to dock it in their dock and play on TV. So they're like, okay, well, you can go grab your Switch and play in the corner or play in your room or whatever. And, you know, over summer, you can bring it wherever you want to go. And it just turns into this essential mobile entertainment system that, you know, still offers most of the benefits of the Switch. But one, if you break it, it's a third of the price point. Two, if you can't really lose much of anything that comes with it. And I mean, three, it's just, you know, it's got neat colors and all this sort of stuff that kids love. And it has that sort of like Lego brick aesthetic that the 2DS had ultimately as well. So I think it's awesome, but just not for me,
I think it's funny that you were talking about this kid demographic. when I was laughing at the commercial because it's like a bunch of Californians with their Switch lights. And I'm like, this is targeted at Japanese consumers that are just going to use it on the train exclusively. Yeah. Like, that's who this is for, really. If I had to guess, this is for a Japanese market, people that don't necessarily have a TV but want something to do on the train and are willing to throw down a little bit more money to get it. And I think that that's, like, the 3DS was selling like mad in Japan, and it was that same consumer. And so now they're trying to get them all on board with the Switch. And I thought it was super funny the way that they demonstrated all these kids. And like, if you are just playing on the go and you want something that's lighter, maybe a little bit sturdier without the Joy-Cons that are detachable, then maybe this is the version for you. And I totally agree, though. Like, it's not for me, but I'm not going to disparage the idea of it because it's not for me.
Let me ask you something really quick before Isaac jumps in. The Japanese actually had a cheaper Switch version without the dock, and I believe it was the equivalent of like $50 cheaper, so it would have been like a $250 Switch as opposed to a $300 Switch. Would you have preferred... I almost think I would have preferred that, because at least it comes with the Joy-Cons, and then you have the option of buying a dock later on if you do want to play on your television. But you still have the portable thing. You can just buy the portable device if you want to get it $50 cheaper.
I mean, we talked about, like, if we manufactured this thing back in the day when we were talking rhetorical before it was actually announced, and everyone was saying it's going to be a singular unit, and I said just take features out of the Joy-Cons, like the HD Rumble, which they did.
They did.
That's one of the ways that they made it cheaper. But I would have taken that detachable Joy-Cons that have just been pared down in maybe a unique color so that you know that these are the lame Joy-Cons. but just so, like, you're saving a little bit of money, but you're not losing that prime feature of the Switch. Because, like, I'm not disagreeing with you, Patrick. That is the selling point. It is the magic of the console. I, like, brought it over to my parents' house, and I was playing Pokemon Let's Go. And, I was playing it handheld, and my mom was like, oh, that's cool. And I'm like, oh, you want to try it? And then I, like, broke off the Joy-Cons, and she's like, what is even happening with this thing right now? And, like, she was so into it. As soon as she could swing the Joy-Con around, she loved it. She was playing Pokemon for the first time ever. So I'm not saying, like, that's not the selling point, because it is magic. It is pure magic. But I think it's cool that more people are going to have Switches. And, there's plenty to still be played on this. I do think that there's going to be someone that buys this and can't play 1-2 Switch or something when it goes on sale.
Or Mario Party.
They're going to get mad.
Yeah, Mario Party.
Also.
Isaac, what's your take?
So I see this as a positive in a lot of different ways. Just to answer your objection real quick, Patrick, I think this is a good naming scheme because it couldn't possibly get any worse than what they did last year with new Nintendo 3DS. So this is an improvement on that, and it couldn't get any worse than that. So at least light indicates that it's light on features, and, you know, it's completely different than the other normal Switch. But Doug Bowser had an interesting comment where he said he could see this fitting into a household where there are multiple players and one flagship Nintendo Switch. And that's what I think this is for. I think this is for, like, for example, in my family, I have a Switch that's in the living room or whatever. But there's also kids that could have their own little, you know, portable Switches, these Switch Lights, that would fit in more when we don't need more than one docked in the living room, if that makes sense. And they don't have their own TV sort of thing. That would fit in well. You still play Mario Kart. If you do local wireless play, you can have one person playing on the TV, one person playing in handheld mode, you know, cool stuff like that. I think that's where this fits in. And in Japan, because obviously in Japan, Japanese consumers love portable games. And there's a lot of trains, like really good public transit, unlike here in the U.S. And they can sit on the public transit and play games in something much more portable. What I think is interesting, two different things about this. Number one, it doesn't support Labo, which is really strange to me. You wish that this could at least support Labo, but they went with the smaller screen. They pared it down from 6.2.
It's the Joy-Cons, too. Like, I think it does have gyro sensors in it, but it doesn't have the infrared. They don't have the infrared.
That's what I mean. Even if you take two normal Joy-Cons and pair it with the system and then put it in the Labo, it still won't work because the screen's smaller, which is unfortunate. But what I'm really excited about for this is they're running a new processor on this that is a lot cooler than the original Tegra X1. And it's supposed to get 20 to 30% better battery life. Now, if we think about that and extrapolate that out to a Switch Pro, it could possibly mean that we get a Switch Pro that has greatly increased performance on a different version of the same chipset but with the same battery life we have with the normal Switch. So you could have something that was 20-30% more powerful and had the same battery life as the Switch we have now. You know, not the Switch Lite, but the normal Switch. And that's very interesting to me. They redid the cooling system on this Switch Lite, which means maybe it won't have active cooling. So if you ever have used your Switch in handheld mode and you're playing a demanding game, you'll hear that, you know, the fan whine on it as it's trying to cool. And that's because that Tegra X1 that's in it, it's an old part from about 2015. And it needs to be cooled down to keep it efficient or whatever. But on this new one, on these new ones, I'd be interested to see if it is still an active cooling system or if it's passive or it's completely quiet. Because this is completely silent. You know, it looks like it's built like a truck, like every Nintendo handheld is. It's very interesting to me. Now, honestly, I think it should have launched at about 175. But I'm not, you know, I don't know Nintendo's figures. They always like to launch with to make a profit on it. I don't know if they could have made a profit at 175. You know, it was, they probably are at 200. But I think 175 would have been a good differentiation. You know, you've got plenty of stuff. And then for that price, you can get something like two games. So you could get like a Switch Lite, two extra games for the same price as a normal Switch without any games. But I like it. I love it. The design is really good looking. It's not as dumb. It is named as foolishly as the new Nintendo 3DS. I love the colors. They remind me of the Game Boy Color. And I think this is a great time to launch this. But I am more excited as a tech enthusiast for the possible Switch Pro coming out this year. They've confirmed it's not this year, but next year sometime. I think that's going to be very interesting. But as for this, I think it's great. They made the screen smaller, so that's set. So it's a 720p screen, so it should look even sharper than it does on the normal Switch. And on the normal Switch, it's always looked very sharp. But a 5.5-inch screen, you know, all the reviews I've read, or the first impression, it doesn't get cramped or anything. And that's impressive to me. This is, as a pure portable, the best portable Nintendo has ever made in terms of power, in terms of the, you know, what you have access to, the library potentially, if they bring other features to Switch. And this is a full-fledged, all by itself portable that, you know, you can play full home experiences on, which I know you could with the normal Switch, but it's even smaller and more portable. And that's kind of interesting. But yeah, overall, I'm excited. I'm never going to buy one of these because I like to have all the flexibility. After all that? Yeah, after all that, I would never buy one of these.
It's amazing, and I don't.
Yeah, it's, I mean, seriously, it's a case of I've already have a normal Switch. I'm not downgrading. If I was buying one for a sibling, this is the one I would buy because it looks more adorable and they don't need a dock because they don't have a TV, right? You know, a lot of, you know, younger kids don't own their own TVs. But it's just not for me. Like, obviously, I already have the original Switch that has a lot more flexibility. And plus, while I like to play Smash Brothers, you know, Super Smash Brothers, playing it on TV in dock mode with a LAN adapter is a must, and that's not something you can do here.
Yeah, only wireless connections here, so yeah. I'm sure the people complaining about some weak connections for Wi-Fi.
Yeah, it's about to get way worse. Somebody posted that on Reddit today. So.
Yeah.
They've announced that it's you can't dock it at all.
Correct.
Yeah.
How does it charge? Does it still charge through USB?
Yeah, it charges with the original brick that shipped with the original Switch. So the little brick you plug into your dock, that just ships with this.
Huh.
You know, so you just plug that in. At least they bundled a charger with it this time. Because remember, true. The new Nintendo 3DS launched without a charger. Yeah, so.
I still had my 3DS charger, so I was cool. But
yeah, it didn't.
Yeah, that was. I think you all forgot to mention the one massive change that has been made to this thing.
What's that?
It has a traditional D-pad.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, yeah. I'm stoked on that.
There are so many people that, like, have been demanding a D-pad or, like, a set of Joy-Con that have a D-pad. I don't care at all.
Neither do I. I actually really like the buttons, to tell you the truth. I use them too. Way over the joystick. I prefer them, especially for side-scrollers. I love the buttons. I like them better than Nintendo's D-pad from on their Pro Controller, which I think is garbage. But
the D-pad and the Pro Controller is uniquely terrible. So
yeah. I'm afraid of Nintendo, who invented the D-pad. I'm afraid of them doing another one because I didn't like their D-pad on the Wii U gamepad either. Yeah, so I like the buttons quite a bit. But okay. Whatever.
My big question now is because I have some friends who are absolutely going to buy one of these things for sure. Day one. Shout out. You guys know who you are. And they also own a home console. But my question is how is the game transmission going to work? So when you want to like leave your home console at home and you want to be able to bring your Switch Lite on the go, how are you going to be able to play the same titles with like cloud saves presumably, or how is that going to transition, you know?
Well, you can only have one active main console at a time.
That's correct. Because
the way Nintendo sets things up. So you can't really do that.
Ooh, that's unfortunate.
You'd have to completely transfer your entire account, which you can do.
Or you can set one Switch to offline mode, like most of the time, right? And it will keep those titles all in there because there's no way of it knowing, you know, I'm not connected. So Like generally, you could probably do something like that where you have your main account on your one Switch, and then like you do something offline with the other one or something. There's workarounds I've seen before, but it's a workaround. It's not. There's no official solution. Like, oh, I can just pick up and play right now, like it is on Steam. You know, where on Steam, you have it on one PC, you have it on another. You just drop it, save it to the cloud, and it'll pick it up on your other PC. There's nothing like that here. So it's going to be really kind of aggravating if you want to try to do something like that. But I don't think there's going to be that many usage scenarios for that, because why wouldn't you just take your Switch to begin with? Like,
it is more durable. That's maybe why.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point.
Didn't they announce some sort of a shareable game or something like that, or shared libraries or something?
I didn't hear about that. I saw that was Doug Bowser said you would be able to transfer your saves over to your information over to the new Switch, but he didn't say anything about sharing it, I don't think.
He said, I found the quote right now real quick. Bowser says about the Switch Lite that, yes, you'll have the ability to transfer between devices your gameplay experiences. More to come there, but that's the intention. So who knows? Maybe when it comes out, we'll know a little more.
Well, there you go.
Well, that would be nice.
I hope that's good. That'd be really nice.
That'd be very smart for Nintendo to do that.
But knowing their history with online, I'm not optimistic about it. I'll have to wait and see. You know, but that is pretty awesome. But yeah, the trailer was like, these things look really cool. But, you know, just honestly, personally, if I was advising somebody to buy one, I would think if you're ever going to use it with the TV, you know, get the regular Switch model for the extra $100. Even though docks aren't as expensive as their MSRP suggests, they only usually go for about $60 on most websites, even though their MSRP is like $80. So, but I mean, generally, you're going to have any flexibility you have is better than not having any, is the way I look at it. Still, I mean, for families with a main Switch, this works well.
Sure.
Yeah. And ironically, the first main series Pokemon game to be on a home console has a new portable only console version. So that's cool.
It looks so sweet, too.
It looks great, but it's just very funny that people are very excited about being able to play on a home console, and now there's a Switch Lite that is portable only.
Totally some irony there. How about colors? How about color schemes? If you guys had to get one of the color schemes, which one would you get?
Undoubtedly the Pokemon one looks so sharp. The light gray with the blue and red button scheme.
Yeah.
Turquoise looks beautiful. That's the one I would get.
I like the yellow one. I'm a fan. I'm not going to lie. It's out there.
Well, I hate the color yellow, so that probably wouldn't work.
Yeah, fair enough. Come on, give me some crystal. Give me some see-through ones, please.
Oh, yeah, like a GB color throwback line. Would be really
please.
Cool.
Please. Yeah.
But
I think by GB, he means N64.
Well, they had
jungle
those
green, ice green, ice blue.
True.
Yeah. That was like the glacier purple. Yeah. Or whatever they had.
Huge glacier purple guy.
But yeah, I mean, there's some cool... That's the cool thing about these is Nintendo always has the neatest limited edition handheld designs. Mm-hmm. And seeing those on Switch Lite is going to be fun. Even if, you know, I'm probably never going to buy one, it is still neat that everybody has their own option. I think the more options you have, the better it is. And like I said, I honestly don't think the message is as confusing as Patrick was saying, but there is some confusion to be sure about this, because there is going to be somebody one day that buys a copy of Mario Party with it and comes home and is like, I can't play this at all.
I guarantee you that's going to happen. There are going to be some disappointed kids who realize they can't play their Switch on their TV because their parents didn't understand which one they were buying. Guaranteed to happen.
So be a knowledgeable consumer and actually read all the product descriptions. There are all sorts of icons just sitting there for you, and tell your parents what's what. Anyway, I'll think about getting one of these when Karen brings it to our rooftop party, maybe.
But when the Pokemon one goes up, I'm absolutely pre-ordering it. Regardless, it just looks cool. I'm sorry.
Well, see, Karen can't take it to your rooftop party because she can't set it up on the stand. There's no stand on this one, and she can't hand you a Joy-Con to play with her too. So I mean, it's not like
about. What about when you hang out with the cool kids at the skate park?
Well, there you go, man. See, they're rich, so each one of them has their own Nintendo Switch Lite. They ain't sharing like they were in that original Switch commercial.
Yeah.
Those are Bay Area kids. I mean.
my Splatoon squad doesn't share consoles either when they're doing their tournament or whatever. Anyway, so we would love to hear what you think about the Switch Lite, but before anything else, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're talking Mario Maker 2, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back to N-Express. We are at our main event, a discussion of Super Mario Maker 2. One of the highlights of the entire Wii U lineup was undoubtedly Super Mario Maker, one of the most unique, distinct experiences that Nintendo has ever given us. And it was exclusive to that console at the time. Eventually, it got made on the 3DS, but now we have the full proper sequel on the Switch. And I've got to say, I love this game. I'm really excited about the sequel. I think it's ultimately better than the original, with a couple of scruples here and there. But what a great addition to the Switch lineup. And I've got to know, what do you guys think? Ty, what about you?
My first thing was, I'm on the same boat as you for sure. It's amazing. It's awesome. It does everything that the first one did, but 100 times better. But, I mean, it's so good. It's like, where do they go from here? What do you add in future ones if you ever have to come out with another one?
I've got thoughts on that.
I mean, there's definitely a couple things that I have. But in terms of just the capability of just the making, all the different options that are available to you, as well as just seeing the originality and creativity of everybody else on the internet, it's beautiful. And then the added story mode, too, has just been a joy to play. Story mode is essentially like, it gives you a new way to appreciate just the Mario franchise, just even going back and playing like the original Super Mario on the NES through the online store. Like, you go back and you look at it with different eyes, kind of, which is, it's kind of an exciting experience.
Yeah.
Do you guys like does it work well without a stylus? Because I always thought that was one of the big things about the Wii U version. Designing with a stylus just seems so easy. I tinker with the Wii U version, and it seemed really easy.
I've not created it in portable mode yet, but I would probably recommend a stylus already just thinking about it, because of how small the Switch's screen is, you know, and if you have fingers that are even somewhat big, I imagine it'd be hard and you're kind of blocking what you're seeing on there. But to keep in mind, if you're looking for a stylus, make sure to get one for capacitive touchscreens, because the Wii U screen was restrictive, which means the little stylus that was bundled with it and the 3DS will not work on the Switch. It'll just scratch your screen. So make sure to look for if you want to use a stylus, look for a capacitive one. They look a lot different and they're used for modern, you know, touch screens and stuff. But
I only did Maker in portable mode, and I definitely did miss a stylus initially, but after a while you're just like kind of using your pinky as a stylus instead. And you know, it works still for the most part. But I was definitely like, man, I really wish I had a stylus to pull out kind of like underneath like the 3DS.
This is the funniest. I like that Olive said a different solution. Hey, Patrick, I bought a stylus.
Well, that works then.
Yeah, and honestly, I got a really nice stylus for not expensive at all. I've really enjoyed it. It fits in my Switch case, no problem. So it's always there with my Switch anyway. And the rest of the time, I can just carry it around. And it's like big enough that it doesn't go missing ever. And yeah, I've really enjoyed using it. I just didn't want to smudge my screen. It was as simple as that. My finger works just fine. Honestly, yeah. I had no problem when I was using my finger for the first couple of days, but didn't want any smudges, so I got the stylus.
So I've only created in TV mode so far, and I've actually really enjoyed it. I thought it was going to be really clunky and not intuitive, but it's actually, once I've got used to the UI and get used to moving around with it, it's really fun. And I was surprised with the Pro Controller how versatile it is. That's still a little difficult to do some things, like, and it feels a little clunky every now and then. But overall, I've been really impressed with it. You know, I really do miss the stylus from the Wii U version, but there obviously would have been no way to replicate that. So it's a necessary concession. But overall, I've loved the story mode. Some great handcrafted Nintendo levels there. And the online community is as good and awesome as ever. You know, there's some really fun levels out there. Me and my family put in almost 400 hours on the original Mario Maker. And so I'm really excited about this one because there's so many more tools that you can create, so many more different and unique levels. And the 3D World theme is by far my favorite, because 3D World was my favorite game on the Wii U. It's one of my favorite games of all time. And just having that in 2D and getting to play some more 3D World stuff is really cool.
I absolutely agree with that. I was actually super worried when I was like, oh gosh, 3D World, but we're going to be playing in 2D. How is that going to, like, you know, transition over? How is that going to work? And then, like, immediately, like, I jumped into level and I was like, oh, this feels so right. Like, it's got the same music, and it doesn't have the, like, really floaty sort of feeling that you get with the new Super Mario Bros. World or whatever. titles, that theme, it feels a little bit better, I think. And I'm glad that it seems like the online community also really appreciates that sort of theme better too. I've seen a lot of levels on the popular charts that are in the new Super Mario Bros. The 3D World theme.
Yeah, it has a little bit more of an extensive tool set, some unique items and abilities to that theme. So I think a lot of the time that's going to be a go-to. Granted, the first two stages I've made, I went straight for World and then the Wii. So I haven't used it yet, but it is really cool. I was playing around in it, and I feel like the additions that it brings to the table are really, really great, including some secret abilities that you get after beating the campaign. So it's really, really cool, and it gives me hope for the future, just that there's so much space in those additional themes. I sincerely hope that they plan on adding them, and Nintendo, please, for the love of God, give us Super Mario Land 2.
Oh, for sure. Please.
That's all I want.
How do you guys go about designing stages? Do you, like, when you're starting from scratch, what are your thoughts? Have you guys looked up tips, or do you just sort of start experimenting?
Yes. So there is this one guy on YouTube. I believe his name is Game Maker's Toolset.
Love that guy, Mark Brown. Yeah, that guy. Yeah, Mark Brown. Anybody who doesn't watch Mark Brown, he is a fascinating. He's my favorite gaming YouTuber.
Yep, and I watched his breakdown of how, in the past, with the original Mario Maker, how Nintendo designs their levels. So they start out with a gimmick. They introduce it to the player in a safe space, have them try it out, and then give it to them over the course of the level. And then by the end, you get like the ultimate chance to try out this gimmick and improve your mastery of it. That's how I approach a level, is I start out with a gimmick. So if we're in the forest and the gimmick is like the trees in 3D World, I'll start off with that, show them how to use it in a safe space, and then move on to throwing more and more enemies or making it more challenging towards the end of the level. You've mastered how to move between these trees and everything. And I kind of draw from him because I want to make level. Nintendo makes great levels, and they do it based off of this same gimmick mentality. And at least in their, you know, in their Super Mario World and in New Super Mario Brothers U, that's how they design levels. And that's why they design them so good and so consistently. If you ever get a chance to watch his video, you should watch it. It's really good.
I agree. I've seen all of his stuff, including that one. And he actually did a brief one for Mario Maker 2 as well.
I haven't seen that one yet.
It covered the same sort of ground. But that's a solid starting point for sure. That's why I was wondering if anybody kind of used that. It's funny you say that, Isaac, because I love Mark Brown and Game Maker's Toolkit. And he does boss keys as well. Which
I love those.
The Zelda Dungeons. Yeah, everything he does is so, he really breaks things down and does great analysis. And I always thought that if I was going to do Mario Maker levels, that's exactly the starting point that I would take as well. It's basically how to design traditional Mario Maker levels or Mario levels. And it's a great little example of
how to genius, it. Actually. I wish that Mario Maker 2 had honestly presented it that way, because I've actually never heard of that before, but it makes a whole lot of sense now that it's being presented in that way. But the way that I would go about it usually is I would play through a mission on story mode, or two at least, and I would look at the gimmicks and how they presented those in story mode, and then I'd be like, okay, cool, those are awesome. How do I combine those to make a fun level or something there along that line? Yeah, and then I would just take those gimmicks. But I like the building action or the reaching a climax of that gimmick or whatever at the end. And I think that's pretty interesting. So yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's kind of how I approach it, is pick a theme and see how far I can stretch that theme, gradually making it more and more difficult. Like the first stage I built was all about surfing on shells. That was like the whole theme. And just seeing how far I could take that singular idea. And by the end, it's pretty sadistic, honestly, but it's still like, I feel like it was still on that like cusp of this is fun and just fair enough, even if the challenge has escalated to a point that I know my buddies on Game Boys were just like, nah, I straight cheesed that part. I didn't want to master this.
Okay, so that, Tim, brings me to the point. I want to ask, like, because when I played the original Mario Maker, a lot of times it was just sort of like, it didn't seem like they sorted them very well. And you'd run across a ton of just messy levels of people who just sort of threw a bunch of things in there and they didn't really know how to design anything. And a lot of them just weren't very fun. How easy have they fixed that? Have they made it easier to find the good levels? Like, and, you know, does that whole thing work? Can you find the levels that you really actually want to play?
So to that, actually, maybe I am lucky, but whenever I go onto online courses, You can tab over to popular, and it's just the most played and popular levels at a given time. And every single stage that I have played from that category has actually been sensational and pretty on par with the stuff that Nintendo offered in its story mode. So I would say that overall, my experience has been so much better than Mario Maker. And they also have different selections when you finish making your stage. There's categories that you can select, and pulling up those categories, thank God, the autoplay levels.
Yes.
Can all
yes.
be categorized as autoplay. So I have yet to touch one, thank God. Yeah. So so far, I've had such an easier time finding really solid stages that it almost feels like if for that reason alone, Mario Maker 2 is worth it.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. And being able to, creators can put comments on their levels telling you different things about them and stuff. And the comments are back after they were nixed. If you remember, during the end of life in the original Super Mario Maker, there was like a year and a half where there were no comments anymore. And because of what they shut down Miiverse. And so having comments back is really nice. Another thing I really appreciated is all these different tools. I don't play that many of them, but I love watching creators on YouTube, such as DGR, play a lot of these troll levels. And with all the new... all the new components and everything, people were putting together some really creative troll levels, and it's really fun to watch them. Now, playing through myself, I don't like, but watching other people play through them, it's just getting really better all the time. So,
yeah, I've yet to play a level that I didn't like from the popular bar or whatever, just because, as they were saying, you know, those comments make it really easy to choose something depending on what you're in the mood, even what you're in the mood for, you know, like there's like the short and sweet one too, if you just want to do like run through a real quick level, like pop up short and sweet. And then there's like themed levels that are so much fun. Like Lazy Boy, I played, it was on the popular page. There was like an Olimar's Pikmin adventure that was on there, where it was like in Super Mario World, and you were like picking up little, I forgot, whatever the seedling Goombas are that you can jump on and then throw. And so you were throwing them to like get through different challenges, make it through the level, and end up in a rocket ship at the end that, you know, flies you up into space or whatever. It was an awesome level, and I was like, this is so great. I never would have found this without this really like amazing popular feed or whatever.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And I feel like, as we mentioned, like with all the extra tools in the creator, you're just seeing so much more variety in gameplay and mechanics. Like, I know a lot of people got kind of frustrated. Like, all of my stages in Mario Maker, just coincidentally, I had so many puzzle mechanics, and I just was having too much fun creating unique puzzles that you actually had to, like, stop and think about. And then I lost a bet because of that, and had to buy Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival, and I'm still salty. But, like,
hey, because... I like that game.
What? Okay, discussion for a different episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
But because there is so many more tools, I feel like there's so much more creativity at play. And I've just seen some truly unique, outstanding concepts that I had never even begun to conceive of. Like the flying birds that you can ride on. I'm sure you guys have seen this online or maybe even played it yourself. And just... unbelievably creative people who have made sensational stages, and I love this game so much. I honestly, Patrick, if you're into good Mario stages, I would say this is what Mario Maker should have been. Nintendo supplies you with a good 100 or so, and then the communities actually provided me with thousands more, and like it's not slim pickings, and it's easy to find them. And on top of that, you have the opportunity to then go and troll your friends with your own stages.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it. I played one level that was a guy had recreated, if you ever played Super Mario Sunshine, this legendary Sandbird level.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, he had went and recreated it in Super Mario Brothers 3, where you're getting these 8 red coins and while the Sandbird flies along. And I hated that level in Sunshine, but that's another point. But it was really fun in this, and I was like, wow, the creativity. You know, it's just, and it even had Sunshine's Isle Delfino music, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And it was just really, really cool. I'm really excited because they've done the 3D world theme now. I would love to see a theme that was like, I don't know, like a galaxy theme that was 2D. There were some 2D sections in Galaxy that would be really neat as DLC in the future or something like that. Or Super Mario Land 2 theme, like you all had talked about, because there are some Mario Land mechanics hidden in this game that I've seen. Like, yeah, there is a little power-up. Yep, a little power-up that's the pipe flower, which is really cool, really good. Or the ball flower, I'm sorry, the little cool toss back there. But overall, like I said, I've been really impressed with this. And graphically speaking, the 3D world levels in this game look really nice. They're actually so intense on the Switch that they run at a lower resolution than the rest of the game. So the game runs at 1080p, except for the 3D world sections, which run at 900p, because it's just so detailed compared to everything else. And I think that's really cool, and it gets me excited that they might have the tech ready to do a port of 3D world to the Switch.
There you go. Well, piggybacking on that creativity comment, too, I felt like, as I was playing it, like, a lot of the levels really gave me vibes of one of my favorite kind of sleeper picks from the Wii U, which was NES Remix. And it's just got those like weird sort of 8-bit feelings. Because whenever Nintendo creates Super Mario levels, they always feel like they're always a part of a certain aesthetic. You know, they feel like they belong to the Mario brand. But then once you release like the making tools just to the community, that brand is gone. So you can do whatever you want to do. And things can get so weird and wacky and odd and strange that it's just so interesting to be able to play all these different just things that have come out of people's heads that don't feel Mario but look Mario but are still fun like Mario, you know, and it kind of captures that magic about that was big in NES Remix. So
I know, and I love that, like, of course someone has already made the Mother Brain course from Super Metroid. Like, there are some really creative individuals who are using the limited tools of Mario to create moments from other games, and I really love that. And I think that there are some community members who undoubtedly can make stages that feel like Mario stages aesthetically and conceptually and thematically. And I'm really into those stages because I'm like, this just feels like a Nintendo stage. You're really good at this. So in terms of that, like, that's where all of that makes this game worth picking up. There are experiences in this game that I would like to talk about a little bit that I dislike and I've yet to actually really have fun with, and that would be the online multiplayer, which is terrible to say as someone who, I mean, I have a co-op multiplayer show on the site. It's what I play games for most of the time. But, oh man, Mario Maker 2 does not offer what I want in terms of multiplayer.
Same.
At all.
Same.
For so many reasons.
I was not a fan. It was so laggy because it's peer-to-peer networking. And it was just, I had a couple matches that ran pretty smoothly. But people can just, you know, you can have one person out of the four completely just mess you up. Absolutely. And then you lose points. And you have one person just kind of attacks you only. And then you lose the points or whatever. And I've just had uncontrollable lag, which just is bad enough in something like Smash or something like Mario Kart. But it's downright experience ruining in a platformer, because when you lag, you know, when it lags all of a sudden when you're jumping or something, and then the inputs get all messed up, it's just disastrous. And it's just the way Nintendo's built their network. There's no way around it. When you have good infrastructure, it's not a problem. When you're playing with people who are on, you know, hardwired connections, or it works well. But otherwise, it's been a dumpster fire most of the time.
I was definitely feeling the same thing. I'm working on an article right now for Goomba Stomp, entitled something, you know, tentative title, of course, you know, Super Mario Maker 2. Their online mode it's a beautiful, chaotic mess. It doesn't work well at all in any way, shape, or form. But I've actually had some, like, great, exciting moments because of it. Like, in spite of all the lag and just how terrible it plays and all those sorts of things and how the lag ruins the platforming aspects. But sometimes when it works, there's these very weird glimmers of, like, oh, this is how it should go. Like, for example, like, I was playing co-op mode or whatever, and there was, like, a part where there was a platform that was rotating back and forth, and myself and another player landed on the same platform. And instead of, you know, waiting for me, the guy actually physically picked me up and threw me off of the platform, which then started, like, for the rest of the match, it was just me and this other guy throwing each other off of various platforms until the level timed out. And it was a fun experience. I don't think it was how Nintendo envisioned that whole online interaction going, but I was laughing and smiling and having a great time. I still have yet to honestly even win a co-op match because of just how terrible they've been. But I've played probably a good couple hours of it so far, just for, you know, both in co-op and in competitive mode.
See, I feel like when I played cooperatively, my experience was overall better because maybe the mentality was there that we're all working together. And in general, the stages that I came across in that setting tended to be a little bit more cohesive. As soon as I hit the competitive, one of the issues that I had, that's where I experienced the most. I had slowdown when I was playing with a couple of individuals. And I actually had one match where someone quit halfway through and then everything sped back up to normal pace. Mm-hmm. So I was like, wow, you singularly were ruining this for everyone else. Like, if you don't have the internet for it, maybe don't play, like, no offense. But then the real issue that I had was that's where I felt like most of the stages were dumpster fires. And it felt like at the end of the stage, everyone gets a chance to vote on how they felt about it. Boo, meh, or I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And the highest rating I saw in, like, 10 straight games was meh.
Yeah.
And everything else, everyone booed. And there were like several stages where I'm like, maybe if this was just a singular player doing a challenge stage, this would be a cool concept. But when you have four people trying to land on single blocks, single ice blocks with a tanuki leaf, like this is just hot garbage.
Yeah.
It's borderline unplayable. The fact that someone won in the end was a miracle.
Yeah. There's hardly any checkpoints either.
Yeah, well, it was like the stage took all of 10 seconds to beat it.
The worst part are the ones with the coins, that everybody collects the coins. So if you collect coins, it counts towards the person who's ahead of you. And I didn't realize that because it says, you know, you have to collect all 100 coins in order to, or like there's some of the collect 100 coins, collect 102, or whatever, to finish the level. But if you collect coins, if somebody's in front of you, you know, and they're right there at the end, the other people are collecting coins basically for them. So it just has to be all of you together collect 100 coins, which makes it like it's kind of aggravating. I feel like you're helping everybody who's ahead of you, and like you guys said, like I was mentioning earlier, the peer-to-peer network thing just makes it just kind of trashy to play.
Yeah,
and when you have four people, the chance is so much higher that you can get somebody with a bad connection than if it's just one-on-one.
I'm surprised you can't check the pings of all of the players because I was trying to figure that out. Like, can you check that at all?
No, it shows in the bottom right when you're loading it up. It's like a little bitty wireless signal thing. But I've got 2 out of 3 bars like 90% of the time, and it's still people that are like...
Yeah, my Switch consistently insists that I'm running at 3 out of 4 bars.
Huh. Yep. And, I mean, it'll tell you, nope, you know, or tell you, yep, these players, their Wi-Fi is good, and then nope. And, you know, I've had that before in other Nintendo games, like Mario Tennis Aces. It was like that. It's like that in Smash all the time. It's like that in Mario Kart. And you know, it's just the way they built their network. There's no way around it. And unless they invest in substantial, you know, infrastructure, it's just going to always be this terrible.
And not that I need it for Mario Maker really, but like I don't think we need to harp on this too much because the internet already did a thorough job of it. But the fact like this would be so much more fun. All of these modes would be more engaging if you could hop in with people that you know and your friends. And absolutely, you can do that locally, which is cool and exciting if you happen to just live with your 3 best friends who all have Switches. But odds are probable you don't have that scenario. And like, I could arrange to have enough people with enough Switches to do this, but when is that going to happen? You know, like it's not anymore. That now that I'm an adult, it doesn't live in a household with a bunch of boys. So I feel like that's, again, like a missed opportunity. And this might have redeemed some of the crappy levels if me and my friends were poking fun of it all together because we were allowed to party up and then hop in. Even if it was as rudimentary as something like Splatoon 2, God forbid. Like, I just said the words, even if it was as good as Splatoon 2, which is not good. But there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. You can't put your friends in place.
It's a decade behind pretty much any other online experience. But that's just like everybody else has said, you know, for the past year and a half. So overall, the game is really good. I've been impressed by it. And I was really hyped for it going in. I've been impressed by it. All the Nintendo levels are really good. The online community is really good. And it's got, you know, a lot of staying power because there's thousands and, you know, probably soon to be millions, hundreds of thousands, millions of levels, you know, to play.
Something Something that I did notice is that I got the game digitally, and I honestly enjoy having it digitally much more than I enjoy it. Than I feel like I would enjoy it in cart form. Same. Because it's so much more of like just a pick up and play game. Like, it's not like I'm going to sit down and like be like, okay, I'm going to play like, you know, 3 or 4 hours of Mario Maker. It's like, yeah, you know, like I'm in between a game. I would love to pick up Mario Maker and play a couple of creative levels and feel wowed and then go on to something different, you know? Now, moving forward for me, at least, I guess, when I'm playing it, what did you guys think?
Yeah, I got digitally too. I mean, I got that and Smash digitally because I figured, and Mario Kart, I rebought that digitally because I figured these are games I want to pick up at any time and I have to take the card out and play. You know, they're games that pretty much I don't plan on selling, you know, ever, and because I sell most of my games, and I don't plan on, and I don't want to have to get up every time, go over to the Switch, pull out the cart, put in another card every time I want to play, you know, this specific game. Now, normally I buy physical for Switch games, but these three titles in particular, I just felt like it was the best decision to go digital with it, and didn't help. You know, it didn't hurt that I got it day of, sort of thing.
So. No, I bought physical, and I do like how easy it is to hop in and start working on a course, and then put it down within moments. That's really convenient. So I understand having it digitally would be convenient in that regard, but I always buy physical, so that's how I approach this too. And I think that was the right choice. It looks good on my shelf. So
makes sense.
But overall, no, super impressed with this game in general. The course making is so solid. The Nintendo provided courses are so good, and the height of the community levels, they're high highs. I think there's some creativity that is on par, if not exceeding, what I think even some people at Nintendo could imagine. People are just so inventive, and it's really, really fun to see people just given the tools to create these stages. There are some other issues that I would like to see ironed out, and I do appreciate hidden secret abilities like the poison mushroom, but I would like to see that ability provided throughout all courses and not just the plain basic ground course. Nintendo, let me make a haunted house level with a poisonous mushroom chasing you the entire way through, please. Thank you.
Yeah, those poison mushrooms are really annoying.
Yeah, but I had...
It's a fun mechanic.
I wanted to make a monster movie. and my vision was altered, so well, maybe someday. Anyway, great game. Definitely worth it if you're a Mario fan. And if you're a creator or player, I think this game truly... it is where it should be for both of those crowds. So pick up Mario Maker 2 now. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the inner workings, the guts, and the science of the N64 and the GameCube. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to N-Express. We're at our final segment, a discussion, or I guess a lecture, on the N64 and the GameCube and the technology behind them. I am an entitled gamer. I just want everything to work exactly how I want it, and I don't want to know how it works or why it works. But unlike me, Isaac, thankfully, is an actual informed gamer who knows how these things work and has put in a lot of work and effort to understand them and then share that knowledge with us at Goomba Stomp, and so we wanted to give him more opportunity, like he did in the past with the NES and the SNES, to kind of share how those consoles worked historically, and what made them so great. So, Isaac, the floor is yours.
So with the 64, you know, obviously released in 1996, Nintendo transitions from 2D to 3D, and there's some growing pains with that. So there's this very popular graphics company called Silicon Graphics back in the middle 90s to the mid to late 90s. And Nintendo tasks them with coming up with their first 3D architecture. It's called MIPS. And it is a 64-bit processor that is clocked at 93 megahertz. And they say, okay, this is what we want you to do. We want you to make this system that will help pump out these 3D graphics. They pair this with the famed Reality Coprocessor, which was in a lot of the Nintendo 64's advertising back in the day. And they said that Nintendo 64 would have impressive 3D rendering that would theoretically outperform Sony's two-year-old PlayStation. Because by that time, it was late 96. The PlayStation had been out since, I believe, 95. And it was at this point reaching its almost second-year birthday. Well, the way that Nintendo designed the Nintendo 64, it completely crippled the actual potential of the hardware. So they designed this console to output upwards of 1 million polygons. But most of the time, because of the console's limitations, it was limited to around 100,000. And that was because of the way it was designed. Now, it was revolutionary. Before I get to its criticisms, I will talk about its pros. This system launched some of the first anti-aliasing techniques that we have ever seen. So today's, if you're familiar with FXAA or MLAA anti-aliasing, that was launched here, real-time lighting. And it had a fully programmable GPU that a lot of people would help with designing levels and stuff within the games. Had built-in trilinear MIP mapping, which allowed for cleaner textures than on PS2 and Saturn. And it also pioneered several techniques that are still used in modern 3D game design, including level of detail scaling, which basically means how far objects load in the game. You know, having those load in at different, so stuff that's far off looks kind of, you know, muddy, stuff closer up looks cleaner. That's level of detail scaling. Clipping, large environmental textures, and advanced texture streaming. And for developers that were talented and stubborn enough, like Rare and Nintendo, to work with this Nintendo 64, great things could be achieved. However, for most of developers, its fundamental design crippled its potential. One of its biggest flaws was its texture memory. So textures in games are basically the images that are stretched off across polygons. So for example, in most rudimentary 3D games, if a character was wearing a shirt, their character would be drawn with a polygon, and then the shirt would be a texture. Well, the Nintendo 64 launched with only 4 kilobytes of texture memory, so developers were forced to make serious concessions in texture design. And textures are notoriously bad in the Nintendo 64. They look muddy, they look washed out. And that's because developers were limited by this 4 kilobytes of texture memory. They were forced to use a technique which was revolutionary called garage shading to make up for these limitations. And that's if you look at a game like Super Mario 64, you know, the characters look cartoony and they look very colorful. And Mario's hat, for example, is a very like bright shade of red. That's because they're taking a texture and smearing it across there to save on that text on that 4 kilobytes of texture room. And it was revolutionary, but it created most of the games looking very cartoony. If they tried to go for a realistic look, they couldn't achieve it. Notably, on Nintendo 64 games, the faces on, you know, characters drawn with polygons look very rudimentary, and that was a flaw from this. Additionally, the system's GPU, or its graphics processing, had to go through the CPU to access the memory, which is extremely inefficient. Most of the time in modern systems, GPUs have their own memory, but in this case, it had to go through the CPU, use up the CPU's power to get to the memory, which created all sorts of problems and made it very inefficient. The biggest problem, and the most notable one, is the decision to go with cartridges. So most of the time, these cartridges were limited somewhere around 64 megabytes of storage. In comparison, Sony's PlayStation had 650 megabyte CDs. So games like Final Fantasy VII, you know, they had these huge FMV, full motion video cutscenes, spread across multiple discs on a scale that just wasn't possible in Nintendo 64. If you look at most Nintendo 64 games, all of the cutscenes are real time, which means they're being drawn by the Nintendo 64 as stuff is happening. There's no pre-recorded video or anything like that. And a lot of the music is very basic because it has to be sampled. There's no idea of a full orchestral soundtrack or anything like that. And despite all of its successes and all its revolutionary steps in taking Nintendo to that next level from 2D to 3D, it sold terrible. So basically, it sold less, almost a third of what the PS1 sold. You know, PS1 sold 102 million units. Nintendo 64 sold 32 million units. And it punished Nintendo being stubborn in a way, because Nintendo 64... they were pushing and pushing and pushing to get this console out to beat Sony on raw power, and they overlooked a lot of these fundamental flaws. And so there were some talented developers, like I previously mentioned, like Rare, who came out with some really good-looking games on the Nintendo 64 for the time. and games like I believe it's the original Rogue Squadron. They're just really good looking. They outperformed what PCs of the day could do. Games like Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time that looked really good, but for most of the developers, it was a pain to work with. It was one of Nintendo's hardest systems to program for, and it was just designed badly. Because the game, I mean, the parts in it were very powerful, but they were linked together very inefficiently. So, overall, I titled it The Crippled Giant, because it had potential. It had a lot of potential to be a very powerful system, but it poor design, the decision to go with cartridges, and the overall Nintendo's just general stubbornness prevented it from being as successful as it could have been.
How much did the memory pack help it out? Or whatever that thing was, like the Rogue Squadron you talked about, because that, I think, could be played.
That added a little extra RAM. I don't have any details here on how much RAM the N64 had, but it did add more. So games like Perfect Dark were actually playable. They would run at like 15 FPS without the without that extra memory. And the extra memory allowed them to run better. It allowed games like Donkey Kong 64 to run better. It just generally allowed for just a smoother experience, from what I understand. But it did not get around that texture memory limitation, because that texture memory limitation impacted how clean graphically games could look. And that didn't address that at all. And it still didn't address the problem of the graphics card the GPU having to go through the CPU to access memory. And so it did help, but it was kind of a Band-Aid on this huge wound that just the overall art design had.
And I know Tim will disagree with this, but I mean, N64 games are pretty ugly now. You look back on them, and they're just super, super ugly. It's hard to look at them after today's... you know, how far 3D gaming has come, which is, you cannot say for the Super NES and even the NES.
They're notoriously less attractive, and I won't disagree with you that the sprites from the SNES day today hold up so much better, but there is some artistry at play, and I like the polygonal abstractions that we got, and I think there's something very classic and artistic to them, as Isaac was alluding to, and now we kind of know why everything looks the way that it does, bright, colorful, and cartoony.
Yeah, it was a limitation. They had to go around it, and then props to them for finding something that could get around that, but honestly, the system should have been designed with more texture memory to begin with. That was just a critical oversight, to have such powerful components be limited by something as, you know, prosaic as texture memory is kind of aggravating. But,
so,
yeah, go ahead.
You said that they may have learned a lesson. Did they, in fact, when they designed their next system?
Yes, they did learn a lesson, because for their next system, obviously, they went with the GameCube. And when they were designing this, they were done with the previous company they had, which was Silicon Graphics. Yeah, they were done with Silicon Graphics. They said, all right, you know, we weren't impressed with what you had at all. So what they did was they went to IBM and ATI. ATI doesn't exist anymore today. Basically, they're known as AMD today. And they had them design a system from the ground up. That would be, according to Howard Lincoln at the time, 33% above the projected performance of this PS2 and twice as fast as the Sega Dreamcast. So they were very excited. Fans were excited, and everybody was pumped up for what this new system would be, codenamed Dolphin. And similar to so the GameCube was made up of two key components, the IBM's Gecko CPU and ATI's Flipper GPU. Obviously, Flipper being a pun off Dolphin, which was the codename of the system. Haha. Gecko was cheap and easy to produce and power efficient. Three key factors that allowed it to play nice with the GameCube's real powerhouse, which was Flipper, the graphics card. After a nasty breakup with Silicon Graphics that I previously alluded to, Nintendo contacted ArtX, who was a company that ATI bought out later to develop this. Originally clocked to 200 MHz before they downclocked it before launch to 162 MHz, Flipper was potent, efficient, and leveraged several technologies, including anti-aliasing that had been designed with the 64 that were substantial advancements. Part of its advancement came from how Flipper utilized 3 MB it had of on-die memory, which is very fast. So the closer you have memory to either the CPU or the GPU, the faster it's going to run. And so Flipper had 3 MB directly on the die, which is going to be very, very fast memory. And with over half of the GPU's 51 million transistors dedicated to this 33 MB arrangement, Nintendo leaned heavily on that to produce stuff that was almost as fast as contemporary PCs. While there were some flaws in its general design, that showed ATI's lack of involvement, because ArtX had designed this chip and ATI came in later, Flipper was still cost-effective, fast, and ran very cool. Miyamoto, in an interview, talks about, before the GameCube launches, about the Nintendo 64 being something that weeded out the bad developers, gave them a lot of good developers who could handle hard stuff, so that when they got to the GameCube, they had a system that was easy to work with. It was much easier to design around. And a lot of that came from this fundamental design philosophy that surrounded Flipper. Because Flipper was just so easy to work with. It was a dream. It could run games at 480p, which was just mind-boggling back then. And it allowed for a lot crisper graphics than they had before. Anyway, while the original Xbox supported HD output for some games, the GameCube was still markedly more powerful than the PS2. If you look at multi-platform games like Resident Evil 4, the GameCube outperforms the PS2 substantially. And during the time, it was easy to tell with multi-platform games, the GameCube was more powerful. The problem came down to, obviously, the GameCube didn't support DVDs. It was stuck with 8-centimeter mini DVDs that was the standard, and it forbade any use of full-size DVDs. Although, ironically enough, if you hack your GameCube today and take off the shell, it will play full-size DVDs. The shell wouldn't allow it. And the PS2 held more, their discs held more storage, and that precluded a lot of multi-platform games from coming to GameCube, even if they wanted to, but even if it was more powerful, because these PS2 games held more. So they got bigger soundtracks, they could have more textures, they could have all sorts of other stuff. Anywho, the GameCube was way better looking than the PS2. It was designed better. The PS2 was a pain to work with for developers, but it just did not catch on. It sold a paltry 21 million units over its lifetime, compared to the PS2's somewhere around, I believe, 120 million consoles. So they launched it a year later than they were supposed to. They launched the GameCube in 2001 instead of launching it in 2000 like they had wanted to. They launched it in the middle of a recession in Japan, and it just completely bombed on launch. But technically speaking, it's one of the most fascinating consoles. The whole deal, I could go on for a long time, the whole deal between Nintendo and ArtX and ATI later is fascinating to begin with. But this is kind of Nintendo's generation that gets lost at sea, you know, because it was supposed to be so revolutionary, and it's supposed to be so incredible coming in this generation. And technically it was, but the PS2's ability to play DVDs just really put that nail in the coffin for the GameCube.
So for both these consoles, what do you think were some of these more baffling design choices? Why do you think Nintendo ultimately opted with them?
Honestly, I have no idea, because I'm not privy to what the engineers were thinking about at the time, and there's not a whole lot. Finding interviews with the engineers behind these is almost impossible. But generally speaking, Nintendo wanted the most powerful stuff they could get with Silicon Graphics with the N64, and so they had to compromise on some other things for cost reasons. And that's generally what we think happened with it. With the GameCube, there really was no baffling design decision. The biggest design decision flaw was obviously to go with small DVDs, with mini DVDs. But that was mainly out of fear of piracy, nothing to do technically. I mean, the GameCube will run full-size DVDs. No problem if you take off the shell and put them on there and you hack your GameCube. So it was mainly out of a fear of piracy and stuff like that that prevented them from doing that. But generally, most of the design decisions for the GameCube were fine. They were really good. It was a really powerful system for its time. One of those first generations of consoles that the games still look good today. You go through that rough patch from about the Super Nintendo to the GameCube where games look real rough. But the GameCube games today, I mean, if you get a game, if you have an original model GameCube, a DOL 001, and you have an HDMI adapter, those games look really crystal clear on an HD screen. So, I mean, GameCube was designed well.
You talked about how some of those other consoles, even the ones that we like the Super NES, that they were compromised in many ways, that they didn't perform up to what they could have. And it sounds like this one kind of did, but it was also the last time they tried to do that.
I mean, this one put a drubbing on the PS2 in terms of power. Like Howard Lincoln had stated, now it's a little bit of marketing talk, but it really was about a third more powerful. I mean, it was probably the difference between the PS4 and the Xbox One today in terms of power. And it was a much easier system to work with. And it just, the problem was they didn't foresee online, or they didn't care enough about it to do anything with that. That's something Xbox and PS2 both had. And they didn't go, if they would have went with the DVD player on this thing, there's a chance it would have done a lot better. But that, and they try to compete with power on this. This is the only time I've ever, probably of any Nintendo generation, this and the Nintendo 64, the only two times they tried to compete on power, and they lost both times pretty badly. So
yeah, the DVD thing, I mean, I remember that was a massive selling point for PS2s. That should not be underestimated as to why the PS2 sold so much.
Because having a DVD player, the price point of a DVD player versus just buying a PS2 that plays games and DVDs. It was it was so substantially more cost efficient to buy a console and DVD player all in one.
So in 1999, a DVD player cost $599 by itself. And so when you have a, you know, the PS2 launching for, I believe it was $250 in 2001, that's kind of crazy, you know, or in 2000, whenever it launched, for, you know, $250. And it comes with a built-in DVD player. That's just insane value. And this is just something the GameCube couldn't replicate.
And I'm telling you, as a college student back then, and at that point, you didn't see people in their 30s and 40s playing too many video games. So it really was like, you know, college students and people in their mid-20s and below who were buying a lot of these video game consoles. That DVD player meant a ton. And people were talking about that almost as much as they were talking about the games that they wanted to play. But the fact that it had a DVD player, that was the difference.
I think it's funny that at this time, I remember noticeably seeing the difference in power and graphical fidelity in the GameCube between the GameCube and the PS2. But it just got this reputation because of the discs and the titles that Nintendo launched with and continued to put out. The GameCube just got labeled a kiddie console, and that was the term that everyone used, the kiddie console. And it just another nail in the coffin when it couldn't play those full-size DVDs.
I'm telling you, though, when I took that GameCube over, yes, it looked like a little toy, but when I popped Rogue Squadron 2, or Rogue Leader in there, it blew people away. That game still, I think, looks amazing.
It is a graphical showcase for the GameCube. Yeah. It is one of the best-looking GameCube titles.
Yep.
I mean, you look at the difference between that and the one in the 64, it is a world of difference. It is like the leap from the PS2 to the PS3 sort of difference between those two. And, you know, you look at, like, the waves. If you look at something like Wave Race on the GameCube compared to Wave Race 64, the waves, you know, the way the liquids work and everything, it's just, it's crazy the differences between the two. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, like, it's crazy that this is an example of people always say Nintendo should have competed on power. You know, that was the narrative before the Switch, was that Nintendo should compete on power again. They should try to. And honestly, they've not been successful whenever they've done that. They've done their best when they've competed on the features that they offer or on price, either on having a lower price in good games or offering a bunch of features in good games, not on power. They've never been successful competing on power in the home console market. So, I mean,
so with that context, we get a lot better picture of Nintendo, why they play the game the way they do nowadays, and historically what happened. And I really like that context. So thank you for bringing that to the table, Isaac.
No problem.
All right. I think that does it for our show. We should wrap it there before we talk about the GameCube for another hour, because I think all of us could. I really like that console on top of my love for the 64. Thank you, Ty, for coming on for this episode to talk Mario Maker. Where can we find you online?
You can find me on Goomba Stomp, as always, writing articles, hopefully on the front page. You can find me on Twitter as well, the real Ty Davidson. And yeah, that's it.
And Isaac, what about you?
Just at Goomba Stomp. I write articles there. I've got my first one up, and the last part of this series actually should be up in the next couple days.
So look out for that. Patrick Murphy, what about you?
Oh, I'm always at Goomba Stomp. Tim, you can find me at Twitter, at Sorted Cinema. If you're a movie fan, keep a lookout. The Fantasia Film Festival is just starting due to a freak July 4th accident. I will now not be going to Montreal. you know what? Kids, fireworks can be... they can be something else.
But, I'm sure there's a story there.
it's not a really good one, but no matter what, it kept me off a plane. Anyway, but keep an eye out. We're still going to have tons of coverage. Rick's going to be there. We've got a couple other, you know, several other writers that are there. I am going to be getting some screeners that I can see at home. So you're going to see a ton of movie reviews. These are all genre movies, horror, action, like crazy stuff from around the world. If you're a movie fan, definitely stay tuned to the website during the next 3 weeks. That's how long the festival is. And you'll see a lot of reviews for some crazy movies that you might want to catch.
Yeah, and if you want to see some really, really competent writing and some really cool coverage, check that out. If you want some really bad coverage, check out my work on Goomba Stomp and my other podcast, Game Boys, all about co-op and multiplayer, and just tomfoolery and shenanigans, if that's your jam. But as always, if you could go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you listen, drop us a rating and a review, get us into new ears and in front of new eyes. there are people that need to know about the greatness that is Nintendo, and we will yell it at them. So get us there. Give us those ratings and those reviews. It goes a long way. That does it for this week. Go buy Mario Maker and send us those level codes. We would love to try out your stages. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you more next week with all things Nintendo. See ya.